accession number 24198, Rule 5.
This is the third reel of a tape interview with Jim Boyd in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 4th of the 10th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Jim, we've been talking about your experience coming up to your time in Tobruk. You mentioned that you'd arrived in a place that wasn't particularly attractive for you. Can you tell us where you were to be positioned? Do you recall where it was that you were put initially?
No, I couldn't give you that information.
What about the conditions of where you were to be placed? Can you describe those to us?
Well, I just remember the next morning one of the chaps and myself that had come up the day before dug our protection diva, we used to call them, and we just knew where the enemy had us surrounded, and that's about all.
What was your protection diva like? What was it like? Can you describe to us how you made it?
Through the night, well, just more or less slept. We had nothing else to do. The next morning we met the other troops that were holding that outpost, made ourselves known to us that we were there to reinforce them. And,
what sort of condition were they in when you were to reinforce them?
They were very quiet, morbid, fed up, typical, had enough kind of style, which they had. But other than that, we never done anything till the following night when we went on a patrol.
You mentioned the town being bombed and
the harbour.
The whole sort of area being fairly, the sort of place you would like to get out of pretty quickly.
Oh, yes.
The conditions in the line, you mentioned when you were to relieve these chaps. What was it like when you first got there?
Well, there was actually no line that we could talk about. It was just where we got our name from, the Desert Rats, because we're all in different holes in the ground. The mate and I had one hole between us that we dug, and the others had their different places where they dug themselves in, and through the time they'd been there they had reinforced them with bits of timber.
In relation to the conditions that you were to be in, you mentioned the place had been reinforced. What was the feeling of being under siege?
It's a dull sort of a feeling, makes you feel that you're hemmed in, which we were, and very nervous. Your nerves suffer. You can't do much. daylight, you can walk around, it was pretty safe, because the desert heat would stop anyone from making a target out of you, they couldn't see you plain enough. But night time was always a danger. Slight of sound coming near you, very nervous.
You were mentioning that the second night, that you were to go on patrol. That would have been your first patrol. What was that like?
That was just a short patrol, actually, because it was only taking dixies of food out to another outpost to give them a hot meal. We more or less had to just carry the dixie out, everything quiet, wait till they'd had their meal, and then bring the dixie and stuff back in again. Patrols, I'd been on listening patrols where you just laid there for a certain time with your ear to the ground, listening for any noise that may be like shoveling, if they were shifting their front line ahead of us. I'd never been on a, what they call a fighting patrol for prisoners. Sometimes they would order a patrol to go out and get a prisoner to keep check on the troops that were in the area of Germans. I'd never been on one of them. But all patrols were more or less fighting patrols. Never knew what you'd run into when they're patrolling at night too and you're patrolling. Sometimes, I'd never met it myself, but some patrols reckon that they'd been fired on by another one of their own patrols. I'd never struck that short time I was there. But by the time news came around that the whole battalion was going to move out of Tobruk, everyone were all smiles.
Been a tough time for you.
Oh, yes.
Can you give us an idea of the average day in Tobruk?
Average day, yes. You would sleep. If you were awake, you'd go over and visit some of your mates in another outpost, have a talk to them, meet them. Mail, read one another's letters now and again if there was nothing personal in them. It's news from home, different families that you knew. But otherwise, most of the action, call it action, was night time.
How did you keep, obviously there would have been the difficult weather conditions to contend with. Tell us how they affected your situation.
Very little rain. Mostly heat. That stopped you from sleeping a lot in the daytime. You dozed, but not enjoy the sleep. Just a place that no one wanted to be in.
Dust?
No, not so much dust. thicky sand, you'd call a lot of it, I suppose.
Did you ever have a dust storm that you had to contend with?
No, not while I was there. No.
I understand the bugs and fleas were pretty bad as well.
Oh yeah, scorpions, green scorpions. The cure for them, if you got bitten, was just go to the doctor and he'd give you an aspirin. They were non-poisonous, but by God, they could bite. Green scorpions. Make you nervous when you first saw them, but body lice was a big weapon. Human body has to be clean. You can't do that on a water bottle of water a day, 24 hours. Sometimes you'd be lucky if the water truck could get to you. But body lice saps your strength.
Morale presumably would have been affected too, yes?
Oh, yes, yes. You can't get rid of them, you can wash your clothes, but they've already laid eggs in the seams of the coats and trousers, and as soon as they dry off with the heat, they hatch the bloody eggs, and you've got them again, and you never get rid of them.
How did people try and combat lice?
Combat lice. Well, I suppose we all thought that you could wash them and may get rid of them, but as I say, it was useless washing clothes. Just scratch yourself and put up with it. They were sucking your energy out of your body, and there's not much we could do about it.
In relation to the average day, you mentioned you'd sleep most of the day. What were some of the other activities that you would undertake to keep your spirits up? Play games at all? Bets? Cards?
No. I'd be lucky to get a game of cards anywhere. They'd be either having to sleep themselves or trying to. If you had a two-up going, if all bets were on the honour system, no cash to pay your debt, and just on the honor system as to when you got out, you'd fix it up, if we ever got out.
Was there a concern that you wouldn't get out?
I'd say there was. We couldn't see how they could possibly shift so many troops out and bring so many troops in without the enemy knowing about it. But it was done. The Queen's Own Rifles, as a matter of fact, I think were the ones that relieved our section, where Templeton was at the time. They came on. Was under cover of darkness at night time, a destroyer. They come off the front end gangway as we went on the back end gangway, and they were taken up by guides that they'd left behind to more or less put them in position. give them an idea of what they went through, and they took over our positions. We were there, and Jerry never knew a thing about it. It was carried out that well.
I understand the importance of the ships in relation to bringing rations in to you.
Oh yes, you had to have those boats going to the destroyers. It was a 12-hour trip for them, which was pretty hard even on a sailor. 12 hours from Alexandria up to Tobruk, and they'd bring rations in, ammunition, or reinforcements, and take any wounded out, stretch cases. The wounded were kept in a cave down near the harbour itself, and hospital more or less. They'd load the wounded up and take them back with them back down to Alexandria.
Can you tell us what your rations were like?
Bully beef. Memory, I think it was 3 to a tin in tough times. Sometimes you'd get a full tin of bully beef, other times all depends. The boats getting through. The cooks would, as often as they could, make a hot tea time, night time.
So you're talking about the tea?
Yeah, they'd make a hot meal for you, and they'd get that out to you, which was very acceptable. Otherwise, there was very little action went on through the day.
So how did the sort of level of boredom affect you?
Oh, I think it's just bad on the nerves. I think that's what starts you off with your nervous system seems to take the brunt of it. You think you've got nothing to look forward to, and it makes the place look a lot worse than what it is.
In relation to your initial experiences of combat, how long were you in Tobruk before you experienced your first incident of combat or shelling?
I suppose our first lot of shelling, I suppose, was in the first 24 hours we were in there.
Can you tell us what that was like? Can you describe to us what it was like to be shelled?
Yes, the bloody artillery shelling, in my opinion, is most nerve-wracking thing of the whole lot. You don't know how many guns are firing. You can hear the shell the same as a bullet, but when you hear a shell, it's either gone past you, the same as a bullet when you hear a bullet, but no good saying, oh, ducking your head and everything, because it's too late. It's the one that you don't hear that gets you, that's the main thing. So if you hear bullets, you just keep walking, they're around you, but the one that's going to get you is not the one you're hearing. Those that are hearing have gone past your eardrum, same as a shell. slimy sound as they slip through the air. And if it's close handy, you just kind of double yourself up as small as you can to not make yourself a target for anything.
Your first experience of shelling, how did you cope with that?
Oh, I coped all right, in my opinion. I suppose if I had a handkerchief to cry on, I might have done a bit of a weep, but it was war and you have to expect it. But I couldn't say I ever liked it.
Presumably now you realise what war is like. Up until this time, you hadn't really experienced it.
No.
How was it different from what you'd expected?
Well, I thought there'd be more frontline action in a way, that we would see the enemy sooner than we would know where the enemy was sooner than what we thought. But the artillery wasn't what I thought might be as bad as what it was.
I've spoken to people in relation to one of their concerns being that they wouldn't be able to hold out in relation to their initial experience of going into combat or their initial experience of shelling. Was that something that you were concerned with up until?
Oh, it is. It is.
Why do you think that was a concern for you?
Well, you don't expect the enemy to give you any quarter kind of thing, and if he's getting that close to you, if you can see him, and he can see you, well, that's too close to be comfortable. And it's a case of eventually it's either him, he'll cop it, or you'll cop it from one of them. Not a good feeling at all.
Were you to experience people getting wounded or killed in this particular instance?
No, not on any. Well, one patrol I was on, there was two killed that night, but they never went out to, or we never brought their bodies back. We got out of it ourselves, and they sent a patrol out the next day and brought their bodies back in.
Were you close to them when they were killed?
In a way, yeah, but no sound, just finished bullets flying everywhere and then lying there.
In relation to knowing that comrades had been killed, what was the feeling? This is the first time you've experienced anyone being shot.
I suppose to be hard, you'd say, well, I'm sorry, mate, but I'd rather it be you than me, kind of thing. Survival at all times was the main thing.
Was that something that sort of kept you going? That the idea that, to what degree was that helping you to keep going, that it's not going to happen to me?
No, I think you may have hoped that it was never going to happen to you, but I don't think it was a definite It will never happen to me. It was just a hope that it would not happen to me.
There's always going to be someone else. How were the people in command of you seen?
Well, by the platoon officer, you very seldom saw anyone else in authority. Sometimes an officer from headquarters might come down to have a look at the position and bring his maps down. And you might say, well, who's that? And someone would say, oh, that's Captain so-and-so from headquarters down here to have a look at the position. Just go out of your mind then, kind of thing. He's got his job to do and I've got mine to do.
People like Morshead, did you know much about them?
No. Most of them, General Ursula was one bottle Jack. The generals that were changed in the war, Blamey and Auchinleck and them, that was before my time. There were three or four of them changed in the desert. Supposed to have been messing it up, not doing a good job. I suppose they may have thought they were doing a good job.
In what way did the troops have to just hope that their leaders were doing a good job by them? What sort of trust did you have to place in people like Morshead, in people like Blaney, in people like Auchinleck, if you didn't actually know them or?
No, we, more or less, I suppose, you look at a general and say, well, he's all right, he's back there in a nice Dover. There's going to be a lot of men around to protect him before they can get at him. He's doing all right, I have to worry about myself. I'm not fussy about seeing him. Oh, no, it's... I'd say you had to have a good mates around you to do any good in the army.
People talk of that, the importance of comradeship.
Oh, yes.
How did having good comrades in Tobruk help the situation?
They could lift your spirits, crack a joke, something like that. If you happen to be not feeling too good on the day, they would get your tucker ready for you and things like that. Get some water. You have to have good mates, otherwise you're a loner, that's the finish of it.
Why is that at the finish if you're a loner, do you think?
I don't know how it comes about, but some chaps seem to get themselves in a position where they're made a loner by the rest of the group, I think. Things they must do or something. It's hard to understand, I know, but same as being a prisoner of war, if you haven't got a mate, you're useless without a good good mate in a prisoner of war camp.